Have you ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect? Kruger effect. Here's a little visualization.
Hello, and welcome to the Countercurrents podcast. This unique episode is going to be hosted by me, Millennial Woes, and I'm here with Morgoth, Morgoth's Review, and we're going to talk about at least partly about the skeptic war between the alt-right and the skeptics in 2017. And what you just saw and heard was a video that I made back at the time in late 2017 about that. And it was an intro for a video that in the end didn't get made because Kraut, the main antagonist on the skeptic side, simply bailed out, self-destructed. And it was a very dramatic and bizarre story. I remember a German saying to me, only a German like Kraut could self-destruct this efficiently. But that's a different matter, so we'll get to all of that. Morgoth, welcome to the Countercurrents podcast.
Hello again. It was my idea, because I thought there's so much doom and gloom about that. Wouldn't it be fun to just kind of reminisce about a bit of old internet lore, which was like when things were a bit more fun and a bit, you know, you could have a good laugh. And there was this funny, crazy saga went on. Whereas now it's just like the end of the world and the end of civilization, and it's just, you know what I mean? And so I thought, well, yeah, Wouldn't it be nice to have a sort of lighthearted, fun stream? And then just before I watched like that, some Peter Zahan presentation, which is just like, because you tend to think if you do content, people want to have sort of get your insights on things and stuff. But when you're in the world that we are in, like now, you are in danger of just doing doom porn all of the time. And then you think, okay, let's do something a bit fun and a bit more sort of lighthearted. But the problem is, you're kind of, there's a bit of cope and a bit of escapism to it. So you cannot really win.
No, indeed. I think there is a danger in being too nostalgic, and I think most of us are nostalgic privately. I don't think it's just me. I think a lot of people are nostalgic for things that they valued, periods that they enjoyed, and so on. But obviously, it's something that I try not to talk about publicly too much. I try not to go into it too much because it becomes incestuous and unhealthy, and ultimately, we've got to live in the here and now, and we've got to think about the future. But I think now and then, rarely, like this, it's fine to do something like this. But one thing that... do you want to say, comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been nostalgic for anything that's happened on the internet. If you go back to, say, the first appearance that I did on your thing, that was the first time that people heard me speak, was on the Brexit live stream you did on your channel. So, like, June 2016 or something?
Exactly, yeah.
Even then, you'd think I'd look back on it with nostalgia, but I really don't. And I think whereas there was things happening in my real life at that point, and I will look back on that with some degree of nostalgia, but not much because it's not that long ago. And I think it's the idea of having nostalgia for stuff that happened on the internet is like of itself weird and probably new. I think younger people, because I'm not really of the internet generation, most of my life has been without the internet. I'd say probably 2/3 of my life I never had the internet, or to be honest, even a phone. And so I think maybe Zoomers and the younger millennials get nostalgic for things that have happened on the internet, but not sort of young Gen Xers like me, and probably not the many millennials, if I'm honest. Do you get nostalgic for stuff that happened on the internet?
Well, not generally. I mean, I remember it. It's so ephemeral and so trivial, and so I'll remember isolated things that once happened, like that meme, that funny song that everyone was sharing in 2009, you know, that sort of thing. But it doesn't really add up to much. It doesn't add up to anything, really, because it's all, as I say, so isolated. But obviously, I do have personal nostalgia for, well, the subject that we're going to talk about, because I was involved. And it concerned a movement with which I was involved. So, the alt-right. So, obviously, I wouldn't say that I look back on it fondly, because, you know, there's good and bad, there's light and dark in every era, and 2017 is like that, is no exception. But I do look back on it with some fondness. Something you said a few minutes ago probably gives us a good in to all of this, which is the state of the movement, the alt-right, as it was in 2016-17 compared to now. Because, of course, it's very easy for people to forget. I guess I'll set the scene. So the alt-right, and it's actually necessary to do this for the sake of historical accuracy, because it's so often misremembered. The alt-right, that term now basically belongs to the enemies of that movement, and so they can use it for anything. I mean, nowadays, everything bad is alt-right. I'm bad in inverted commas. So Jordan Peterson is alt-right. Ben Shapiro is alt-right. Elon Musk, I guess. Anyone who opposes the Great Reset, white genocide, the Great Replacement, COVID, lockdowns, all of that, and now Ukraine. The term alt-right has, to the extent that it's still used, it's used completely inaccurately. Sargon of Akkad is now called alt-right. And indeed, some of the figures involved in the Skeptic War will now be tarred with that label, because it's just used to tar people. It's not used with reference to any specific thing. Now, it's worth saying that the alt-right, even back then, didn't refer to a specific thing as such, but it referred to a specific constellation of voices. And it was broadly white nationalist, especially later on, especially 2016, 17, 18. But initially, it wasn't even that. I mean, initially, that was optional. And there were people in it who were libertarians and didn't really care about race. But I think after Trump mania in 2015, 16, it definitely became much more of a central part of the alt-right. But I think that the key thing to state here, because it's so different nowadays, the key thing to state is that there was a sense of power, progress, jollity, gaiety. It was upbeat. The alt-right was not down in the dumps sort of thing. It was actually very energetic and even optimistic, especially once the Trump stuff began, and especially after Brexit happened. There was a surge of optimism that we could actually change the world. And, of course, that seems incredibly naive now. Do you want to say anything about that, Morgoth?
No, I'd agree with all that. But I think if we're going to get into it, I think it's important to kind of set the play field and what players are in. Because, I mean, it does seem like silly to talk about, but the great Skeptic War of 2017, which was like sort of a sequel to the Great Meme War. And in all fairness, you can like laugh, but the great Meme War actually did change the world. Like that actually really did have an effect.
Well, you see
the Trump election.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've got to distinguish between the alt-right, which by that time, by 2017, was pretty much a white nationalist thing. It was a sort of hip, cool way to care about your race, to care about the white race, to care about America, European ethnic groups, nations, heritage, and so on. And it was cheeky. It was irreverent. Let's see. And there were some very edgy memes shared.
Yeah, it was deliberate, especially from the Daily Stormer sort of wing of it. It was deliberately as offensive to political correct mores and sort of post-World War II morality. It was deliberately attacking the most tender sort of points, you know, the most sensitive areas of the meta-narrative that we had after World War II. It was deliberately, like, sort of just prodding them and burning them and then watching people squeal with outrage. So it was deliberately provocative.
Definitely, but I think it's important to say, especially in the context of what we're going to talk about, it's important to say that it wasn't nihilistic. It wasn't just attention-seeking. It wasn't just grifting. I mean, there were some people in the alt-right that I would now describe as grifters that I think weren't really in it for the best reasons. But broadly speaking, the alt-right was concerned with the truth. And so when memes were shared that were offensive to the status quo and to the meta-narrative, post-war meta-narrative, it wasn't just for the sake of destruction. In fact, it wasn't for the sake of destruction at all. It was because we believed that meta-narrative to be a lie and to be largely poisonous to Western people. And we wanted to bring it down. We wanted to neutralize it. So I think it's important to say that one side in this war, the skeptic alt-right war, one side of it was concerned with the truth, even if it was indelicate, irreverent, cheeky, offensive. The motivation ultimately was, we have hit upon an analysis of the world that makes sense, that checks out. And there are other people, most people who are normies, and there are many people who pretend not to be normies, who pretend to have understood something profound, who pretend to be controversial, but they really are not controversial, and they are still adhering to the post-war narrative. And they're still perpetuating lies about many different things. And that brings us to the skeptics. Because the skeptics were a bunch of people who pretended, who claimed that they were controversial and edgy and shocking. And they pretended to be concerned with the truth of things. But really, once they came up against certain truths, they were allergic and scared shitless. And their only response was to try to fight against that truth.
Yeah, and they just to put that into context as well, like, they had much, much bigger audiences than what we did. It was kind of different because there was a few people Red Ice had a big channel, you had a relatively big channel, Alternative Hypothesis was around, a few others. But they were reaching like hundreds of thousands of views on a YouTube video. Like, they combined, they had a reach which was into the tens of millions. It was gigantic.
Yes, but it's important to state that they were minuscule compared to what would later become BreadTube. I mean, it wasn't BreadTube as we now know it, which clearly is pushed as AstroTurf to some extent, I would say to a great extent. The skeptics were not BreadTube. The skeptics were centrists or centre-right people. Do you want to define them for the audience?
Well, yeah, they're classic liberals, and they would bicker. I mean, a lot of them are still around. Sargon's still around, but he's veered much further to the right. But I think that was always the dire. He was always on the more conservative side. Because you do get the classic liberal, and then you'd get Thunderfoot was around. He would be more kind of left-leaning. And then there was like sort of Kraut and Tea. And then there was more kind of nihilistic, spurgy ones. Because there's this fine line with this kind of sort of libertarian, classic liberal stuff. I mean, if that's a whole kind of problem in itself, but it does become unmoored from any kind of grounding kind of truth because the freedoms which are inherent in it. So it's like, well, they feel as if they've got the right and they believe in like absolute free speech, these and sort of individualism and whatnot. And then they believe that there's ways of expressing themselves, and it always veered towards degeneracy and porn. And I think Sargon kind of cottoned on to that early on, but some of them weren't. And some of them, because the alt-right had more conservative sort of values, they didn't like that. They viewed that as being something kind of stuffy and something kind of cringe.
And also authoritarian. They really
didn't. Yeah, and authoritarian. So, and another problem that they had, I think, so they were, they, you had classic liberals, but it was of a sort of, it did have a left and a right to it within that. And, you know, they had a lot of reach. And they, so then they would talk about, it wasn't the woke then, it was like the SJWs. So it was feminists, you got it for the Gamergate, it was a thing. And then so a lot of them would be highly critical of Islam as well, but mainly from a liberal perspective. Islam wasn't liberal enough. Islam, we had to find ways to integrate them and all of these.
Exactly, and it definitely wasn't racial. I mean, they didn't...
No.
They were absolutely civic nationalist about this. They just wanted Muslims to, you know, become nihilistic consumers like them.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, so you get the feminism, you get the pushback with against people like Lori Penny, who was around then.
I remember her... her fondly, yeah.
Yeah. And they do these like awful streams where they like 7 hour long Google Hangouts with like 15 people in them, and they'd like argue about things like who would pay for the roads in a libertarian state and all of this kind of shit. And
yeah,
because it was kind of like fleshing out all of these like issues they had within their own ideology and all of this kind of thing. But when it went in terms of values, the kind of the liberalism of the sort of Rousseauian liberalism or whatever, you know, just be a beast and just wanking over porn all day, like that was their kind of ideal of liberty. It always goes that way, you know. It always ends up because they were atheists. There was a sort of pipeline in through the atheist Dawkins. Christopher Hitchens would be an influence and this kind of thing, so they had a strong atheist bent, and more often than not it led to just like complete degeneracy. So if one of the arguments which would end up becoming a running thing would be something like the low birth rates with whites, and they would frame that I mean, you look back at just how terrible some of their kind of talking points are now. But so it's something like in the low birth rates, they would not see that there was larger cultural or societal problems with that. They would view it as women making decisions. See,
and men making decisions. And, so they, yes, they, this they want to play their video games.
This would be the idea that it was just individuals making decisions about their lives. Now, straight away, you run into a problem with their worldview, which, let's be honest, it's a stupid, a naive, childish, dog shit worldview. And one on the sort of the that is built on this premise that the individual is just sort of completely sort of not influenced or compromised by what's around them. Like this Cartesian thing where you're just this consciousness floating around, and that's like all you're kind of, that's all you have. That's the I. And the problem with that, of course, when we look now, we can see that even back then, long before then, the governments, the media, they were all in the business of molding and shaping public opinion and had been for decades and decades. So if you come in on the premise that everybody is like totally cognizant and everybody knows their own mind and they're making their own decisions up.
Yeah, and everyone is being rational.
Everybody's being rational. Then it's like they look at society, and then that is the society then is a result of all of these people expressing their own free wills and choices. As we see now, like, you know, what is it, like 5 or 6 years later from all of this, we've become so jaded that we mainly just see all of the normies as potatoes. Even that name, normie, is a kind of signifier that they don't have agency, that they are just programmed.
You know? Yes, and I can actually tell you when the NPC meme came about, because I remember that it was the week before I got banned from Twitter. For some reason, I remember... Oh, yeah, it was because right after I got banned, there was a wave of bans on Twitter of anyone who used the NPC meme in their Twitter bio. So the significance of that is... So that was late 2018. So the significance of that is that at the time of the Skeptic War, we didn't have the concept of the NPC. I mean, obviously it existed in video gaming, but we didn't have it as a way to characterize the normie public. We weren't aware of this possibility that many people, the bulk of people, don't have introspection. And I think that really came as a massive surprise to a lot of us. And then, of course, it was completely vindicated 2 years later with COVID.
But it was a kind of, we were right. We would frame it in terms of people being brainwashed by the media, which is crude and unsophisticated by the sort of concepts that we've kind of fleshed out in the years since. But we were still on the right track. It wasn't so much this idea that most people just don't have any inner monologue or agency. But, you know, we were on the right track. But this is why it's important to kind of flesh out your ideas and finally hone your talking points as well, by the way. So you can see there's obviously been where you're onto something, it's people are brainwashed by the media. How does that work exactly? Now, the other side of that, the skeptics of the time, if they would then, and I'm serious, they would then say that we were being conspiracy theorists, that it's that they would mock the idea that the media was being used to brainwash people into having certain opinions, unless probably it was the SJWs. But yes. even then it was all about the education system and universities, and even then they would frame it in terms of a sort of bottom up sort of revolution, you know, where instead of it being top down, which is where we would look at it today.
Exactly, because I remember, and they had the context of the previous 5 years. That was really what they were thinking of. Where did all these SJWs come from? Oh, and now they're dominating the video gaming industry, and they're taking over these panel discussions and whatever. It didn't occur to them, and I don't think it really occurred to us at the time, to be fair, that it was actually top down. It was a decision that was being made, that had been made and was now being implemented. And these idiots, these 20-year-olds with blue hair and whatever, were simply pawns. They were just off the shelf. The universities were churning them out because that in turn had been set up years beforehand. So they were just swimming out of the, like pouring out of the universities. Some of them were being handpicked for, you know, presenters and influencers on social media. They were getting good positions in gaming companies, entertainment, etc. And but they were just sort of ideological Daleks who had been created so as to enforce and perpetuate ideology in a more diffuse manner. So it wasn't just in the lecture hall at this university anymore. They were now all throughout society. And that was what was happening. But it wasn't something that happened spontaneously. It wasn't grassroots. It was absolutely created. I mean, the SJW was created.
Yeah. And so another thing that is just like how sort of hegemonic and dominant they were on... If you look at the demographics of who watches sort of political content on YouTube, the skeptics kind of, between them, They dominated it. They had that lockdown, unless you were like a lefty who would go off and watch their channels or whatever. But in terms of if you were a young white man, your consumption of YouTube content, which, by the way, became like a hot button thing about how all of these young men, these young white men, are watching all of these videos, and it's a pipeline to Stefan Molyneux and all of this. I mean, they did have it kind of locked down. They and I think their content had got stale. They'd adopted a sort of formula, which was moaning about feminism and the Muslims here and there. And meanwhile, our kind of we were a lot of the alt right was actually off YouTube, so we were reading Radix or the alt right site or the Occidental Observer or Countercurrents or the Daily Stormer. So the alt right was actually not that present on YouTube to begin with. We were mainly reading articles, and eventually, when we, you know, at the end of the, say, when you got into 2017, we had much more of a presence on YouTube. And this is where begins.
Yeah, but I think it's worth saying that we had been reading and researching, whereas in contrast, they were largely defined by the interactions that they had with each other on YouTube.
Yeah.
So something would become the truth if X twat skeptic had said it on that hangout with other ex-twat skeptic, high-profile skeptics. So the truth was really a matter of debating tactics and who came out on top. It wasn't really, it certainly wasn't to do with research. It certainly wasn't to do with the actual truth. It was who has been more smug while saying this? Who has been the most edgy and controversial while saying this rather banal thing? Who has owned whom? That was really their sort of metric for, well, what is the state of the art? And it was just absolute nonsense. And as you say, what they were against was the idea that their personal liberty could or should be curtailed in any way. And again, I'm interested in how they've reconciled this with, you know, the age of COVID. I think that's very interesting. But that's not a matter, really. It's important to say that they emerged, first of all, from the New Atheist thing. Thunderfoot and the Amazing Atheist, these sorts of types were, I think, the earliest skeptics. And then Gamergate happened, and it became much more galvanized and much more sort of populist, more lowbrow, because everyone could suddenly moan about feminism in Grand Theft Auto or whatever it is. And so they didn't like the SJWs, they didn't like Islam, and they didn't like the alt-right, all for the same reason, which is these people are trying to reduce my freedom, my personal liberty. So all they knew was appetite. And of course, that in turn brings us to someone like Vosh today. I mean, what does Vosh know but his own appetites, his own unholy appetites? I don't think he really knows much.
Yeah, I mean, he is kind of where the left of their thing has ended up, which is basically just being a neocon. But to be honest, I don't think he's as funny and talented as somebody like Kraut, because his video, or it's just his fat face on a stream. I mean, say what you want, and we probably will, about somebody like Kraut, but there was a hell of a lot of work went into these videos of the editing and everything. They made slick content like that. They were good at what they crafted. It's just that the message was kind of shit. You know what I mean?
Well, in those days they had to be good at it, because you didn't have the astroturfing that goes on now.
Yeah, there wasn't any boosted algos either. You had to find an audience and build, or it was all organically. You know, it was only after like the 2017 into 2018 when they began to fiddle around with the algorithm, so some people got boosted and others got spread.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I think that ContraPoints had started by around the middle of 2017, but that was like. It's strange, because at the time I did take it seriously, but I took more seriously the stuff with the skeptics. I didn't realize that ContraPoints and her successors were actually the establishment stepping in.
The reason, and this is where you get into the conflict, was because they were sitting in nice. they had huge reach. They were also making money, which almost nobody was in the alt-right. Like I say, the main form of content in the alt-right was reading long-form essays and books. So it was unbelievable how privileged, you know, their situation seemed to be. And the problem, to get a little bit meta, was that they were sort of calcified and stuck in a position, a comfy position, and we were looking for places to expand. We felt hemmed in, and it was time to expand our influence. And usually that would come down to, like, you know, can we get Sargon red pilled or something like that? But if you just take a step back from it, what was actually happening was that we were kind of looking to expand our brand and our ideas.
And at that time, we felt that we were able to do that.
Yes.
Because, again, the mass censorship hadn't started yet. It was just around the corner, but it hadn't quite started yet. And so you actually felt, and I said this about my... when I got doxxed at the start of 2017, I did a video responding to it, and it was a sort of triumphant video, because I said in it something like, enjoy being replaced by alternative media. And, you know, I was addressing the newspaper that had doxxed me, and I was saying enjoy being replaced, because I felt secure in my YouTube channel, because it just didn't occur to me that they could and will take this from you. So the point I'm making here is, we felt like the field was open just to expand and take territory.
I mean, at this time, I was just doing the original Morgoth's Review blog, and I did do an article in 2017, I think, and I called it The Metapolitics of the Great Shutdown. And it was basically, the idea of the article was that if we are correct in our ideas, and particularly about who actually has the power, then these platforms have to shut us down. Because if our ideas grow mainstream, then it's so incendiary, they're going to lose power. And, you know, there's people talking about, let's just say, putting people on trial and stuff, and other things. And so it occurred to me that this just can't go on. But this is something a little bit different, which would come later. I think in terms of, like, we wanted to branch out, and then the skeptics began to realize that the only place we could move in terms of political content, getting ideas out, was through them. So the lefties and the trannies and whatnot, they weren't actually standing in our way, so we didn't really pay them any mind. The problem we had was the classic liberals. They were the ones blocking the path. And so conflict was inevitable. And, oh boy, did it come.
And
this is where you get into the main saga itself.
That's our motivations for this war. But they had their own motivation. The skeptics had their own motivation, which was they knew, the smarter of them knew that they were bullshitting. And they knew that the alt-right was saying things that they couldn't counter. And so they felt vulnerable. I think that Kraut and T specifically, personally, and it was bizarrely personal with him. I think they felt threatened by us. Now, the origins of this were quite strange, really. If I recall correctly, it started when a young female alt-right YouTuber called Rage After Storm did a...
She was one of them.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And she started to stray. And she got in touch with me. I showed her some of my videos. And I hate to take credit like this, but it was the way it played out. Because I remember she then did a video in which she was sort of repeating points from my video. But she had this other audience. It was not my fans that she was talking to. It was her own fans. And she was talking about a certain continent. And she was saying things that I know had come from my video. And so she then got taken to task by her fellow skeptics. And that's the sort of proximate reason for it all starting. But as I say, the broader reason was that they felt threatened by us. So do you want to take it from there?
Yeah, I think it's important to note. So basically, they were, I don't want to say grooming, but they did like to, they would spot new talent. And so new classic liberals, new centrist types would appear on the scene. And of course, if you've got like a sort of pretty young girl, who, I think she was like 20 or 19, and it was always a bonus when you could get a young woman who'd complain about feminism, let's say, which she did in the originally. But what always makes me laugh is that she didn't really become a white nationalist as such, but what she did was actually exercise the sort of ideological gist of classic liberalism, which was that so free speech and investigating all ideas, looking at the evidence, looking at the empirical data, and all of this kind of thing.
Yes.
So she made a few videos on race realism and IQ and whatnot, not as a white nationalist, but as a centrist, as a classic liberal, saying, "Yeah, look at the data." And this was a huge, this was a big, big problem, because if that meant classic liberals started to sort of empirically look, using what they should as classic liberals, if you go back to people like Charles Darwin or Francis Galton, like, racism actually does originate with classic liberals in the
18th. It's
racism,
so funny.
Actually did originate with classic liberals in the 1800s. You know, we can come back to that later. And then it was only after World War II when that was no longer possible, and so that all got kind of brushed under the carpet. And so when they were calling themselves classic liberals, they should have been more specific and said, "We are post-World War II classic liberals." You know what I mean? Because they weren't the real deal.
Could have just said, "We are 90s liberals," which is also true.
So the problem they had was that there was this girl was actually being a classic liberal. I mean, she was looking at the evidence and saying, "Well, he has the data. This group does have a lower IQ," and I mean, you know, we just to bring it back down to the kind of spurgery. What happened next was that they did all of these streams where there was like 8 of them slagging her off and calling her a nasty racist bitch. She betrayed us and all of this, helped her out, and she's a racist. We're outright.
Yeah, and they were really ruthless. I mean, they were horrible to her.
Yeah.
I remember one particular stream, and it was Kraut and I can't remember who else. It was people who I didn't actually, most of them I didn't actually know at the time. I wasn't familiar with them, but it was a really vitriolic stream. I mean, they were so angry with her, you could tell.
And so this is where the attack started on her. So the Kraut and Tea tweeted, she actually blogged or something for something which is connected to UKIP.
Yes,
and Kraut and Tea tweeted to them saying, "You may want to check out the racist videos that this girl who writes for you," and they let her go. They all boasted on live streams about how they were bullying her off the internet, and eventually she deleted her channel and she disappeared off the internet. As far as I know, never to come back or be seen again. And they gloated about it, and they thought that was fun. But we people in the alt-right were taking notice of what was going on, and it was as if, like, we were saying, these people are just absolute scum. Like, yeah. so much for free speech, so much for all of your lofty sort of classic liberal ideals.
Yeah, your values and principles. Bullshit.
Yeah. And it all got, and this is where it kicked off. That's kind of like the first kind of chapter.
And I think I did a video about that particular stream, and I said something like, "You can go for this war if you want with the alt-right, but if you do, you're going to you're going to look stupid at the end of it. And, well, I sort of laid down the gauntlet there. Because back in the... See, this is the thing. It's kind of ridiculous and, you know, geeky to say this stuff now. But at the time, it seemed to matter. And I guess it did, because there actually were stakes here. There was the... These people were our rivals, and they were, for what it's worth, they were our rivals. And they were dishonest, and they were clearly dishonest. They were lying about their own commitment to truth and empirical investigation. And they were cruel to one of their own, and they were constantly bitching about us. So I thought, right, well, fuck you people. I was disgusted by their weakness. I was disgusted by their nastiness. I was disgusted by their insincerity, and I was disgusted by their smugness. And so I wanted them to do this, to go to war with us, because I was confident that we would win, and we did, as it happened. But we'll get to that later.
So what happened next was that this is where it gets funny. But we didn't know like the true extent of Kraut's madness, because of all of them, he was the most worried about us. I think Sauron came out of it the best. He came out. I mean, I know it's fashionable to kind of dump on Sauron, but there was all kind of audio stuff leaked, and he came out of it pretty well. To be fair, he wasn't interested in any doxing. He was trying to tell Kraut. He was trying to talk him down. You know, our true enemies are the feminists. All of this. It's so cringe, isn't it? All of it. It's, you know what I mean? This is why I just wanted to kind of banter about it, because it's so fucking cringy.
It's hilarious. But, so, I mean, their naivety in thinking that their enemy was the feminists and the SJWs. but also our naivety in thinking that we could win... we could win YouTube.
Win YouTube. And the thing is, like, we were the most sane people in the room. What happened?
Definitely. I mean, it was people like Alternative Hypothesis, JF Garipi, me and you. Yeah, I don't think there's a lack of sanity in those people.
And so what happened next? But we didn't know this, because this was going on behind the scenes. So Kraut and T made, like, honest to God, he made like a kind of Discord server thing, which he called the War Room. And then he added loads of people from the skeptic community and all over the internet. And he had like, I've never been on Discord. I don't know how it works. Basically, he had different parts of it where they were organizing and collecting data. And they had one, what was it called? I watched Mr. Metagross, like, hilarious videos, like, yesterday. And it's true, you know, because they'd all got raided and screenshotted. And he had, like, a section of it which was just called Targets. And there's a conversation between one of them saying, like, do you not think we should like change the name from Targets to like People of Interest or something? And it's just so.
See, but that again, that shows the truth of the mentality here. They're pretending to be rational, empirical, scientific, etc. But really, they were collecting dirt on their rivals. I mean, they didn't. When it came to it, they were perfectly prepared to play dirty and go personal. Go private, and there, I mean, I remember specifically because I saw it as well. I saw the screenshots and whatever, and the Targets section was that was like one folder, but within that there was a folder for each person who was in the alt-right who was of interest to them, and I was one of them, so I had my own folder, and they were looking for dirt on me. And not just me. I mean, as I say, it was all of them. It was even Coach Redpill at the time, and JF, all of this. So they did have the scientific section, and that's why Kraut, you know, the infamous quote came, academics, please respond, because he did have academics involved in it. So there was this scientific section, but there was also this section about the people that looking for dirt on people. So... As I say, this gives the lie to the whole thing. If you're confident that you can win scientifically, and you're resolute about following the science, believing the science and all that, why would you be interested in collecting personal information about people to rubbish them, to discredit them? I mean, that is just disgusting.
One of the plans that they had was to create an entire internet profile of an attractive young woman in her 20s who would make alt-right videos, but they'd be shit. The arguments would deliberately be wrong, and then they could kind of knock those arguments down in response videos. So they created a fake person to create bag arguments as if she was doing it all right. And
unbelievable. And then
I don't know, maybe they'd get a girl to do the voice or something, and then she'd make kind of alt-right style arguments, but they'd be really badly done, and then the skeptics could make videos tearing her down and saying the alt-right is full of retards. And they even had a name. She was it's so funny when Medicas she was going to be called Tilly Law.
And oh,
she
went, yeah.
The master plan was to create Tilly Law, and they gave her a backstory. Parents were divorced. She spent 6 months backtracking around England, and now she was making, what was it, race realist YouTube videos. what was it, part-time racist or something in the fucking bio.
Yeah.
And it was just unbelievable. And so the master plan was, the big master plan behind all of this was that Croughton T was going to line up all of the big boys, all the people with, 90,000 subs, 500,000 subs, all of the Sargon and Thunderfoot and whoever else was around at the time, and they were going to all line up. Somebody else was invited in, I can't remember. Somebody else had a big channel, but basically the master plan was that they were all going to drop anti-alt-right videos within a few weeks of each other. It was, in World War One, where they did this opening barrage where you just pummel them in the trenches and then you'd go over to finish them off. That was literally the idea. That was the plan, to just kind of blow us to smithereens with their sub counts and all. There'd just be so many people watching us get torn to bits that we'd never recover from it.
Yes.
And that was the master plan. But in the event, Kraut dropped his video saying that there was no such thing as race, and nobody else did a video. They all backed out. So he was kind of climbed over the trenches, shouting on, but he was the only one. Nobody followed him over.
Yes, but indeed. But then the other, and again, I'd have to say, the fact that they were looking at this as a PR thing, a PR war, rather than, about the truth, speaks volumes. But now that we've got to his first video, I've got them. I've got, here it is. The alt-right, it was titled, "The Alt-Right is Too Dumb for Sex." And I think this is the one where he did the thing about the pregnant trout. I mean, it was just... And this is the thing, what came across, and this really was interesting, and it sounds like self-aggrandizement, but it really was notable how less intelligent their stuff was compared to ours. They would misunderstand concepts. They would take things, they would misappropriate ideas, take things out of context. They would draw parallels that were not valid, that were clearly not valid. Again and again and again, they would do this. It was like there just wasn't intellectual rigor. I was not an academic. I wasn't a scientist. And even I could see what they were doing. Even I could see blatant contradictions. And the thing is that they were putting a lot of effort into these videos. And I mean, Kraut had his whole, you know, that whole server. And by the way, I should say, it was called his Kraut's doxing server. And I think that was actually unfair. I don't think the intention was to dox people. I think the intention was the intention was to find dirt on people, which is not, you know, that's hardly benign. It's very cruel, actually. But it wasn't doxing. And I think that that's an inaccuracy that has persisted on our side ever since. You know, people continually refer to Kraut's doxing server. And I think that's a bit unfair because, frankly, we don't need to accuse him of things that he's not guilty of, because he's guilty of enough already. He's guilty of so much dishonesty and egotism and arrogance that we don't need to make things up. But yeah, so he was putting in a lot of effort, not just him. But he had various people helping him. And there were these videos, he made four of them in the end, ultimately. And he sort of announced at the start, this is the start of a series of videos in which I will basically demolish the alt-right using their own arguments. I will examine their arguments and show them to be fallacious and ridiculous. And I guess he might have sounded confident to his own followers, but to us it just sounded delusional, because we were confident in our arguments, certainly about the existence of race and the notion of difference between races and consequential differences between races. I mean, that's just common sense. I think nowadays I would never get into this argument with people. I would just say, well, why do you believe the opposite? Why would you believe that the races are the same? Why would you believe that the races don't exist? Are you fucking mad? Are you blind? Do you believe that different types of dog don't exist just because there are some mongrels? Well, of course they still exist. I mean, it's nonsense. And to me, this stuff is... I mean, nowadays we just take it for granted, but I guess this was our chance to sort of nail it down. And we did that by means of responding to their ridiculous arguments against it.
I mean, again, like the problem they've got is that these are all people who are proud atheists. They were, and yet, like race is just evolution. So the problem that they had was that they have to explain why there would not be severe differences between races, or how that actually happened in the first place. And it's like this thing that liberals do, where on the one hand they love the idea of atheism, they love the idea that everything can be explained by science. Now the problem is, if you just take the out of Africa hypothesis, I mean, I know people dispute that. This is all getting back to proper 2017 stuff, by the way. But then the problem that you're left with is that, like, so people, tribes left Africa, but then they kind of adapted themselves to their new environments, which would be, say, the steppes of Siberia, which is where Mongolians sort of formed, or then in the northern kind of wastes of Europe. And on and on. I know I'm simplifying it, but you see what I mean. People changed and evolved to their environment. And yet all of this is like disallowed because of the dogma of the post-war era. And yet the people who are coming out of this are the people who would say, at the time, without being ironic about it, facts don't care about your feelings. And yet you can see that they were trapped within a certain narrative which they just could not get out of. And it's one of the reasons why some of them went so nuts, is because I think they felt that narrative, that bubble, was under threat. And it was under threat, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, as soon as the empirical investigation takes you, let's say, to before the 1990s, these people freak out. They can't handle it, especially if you get to pre-1945, then they're just shitting themselves, because they cannot handle the idea that, well, they've been lied to and they believe in a bunch of lies, and those lies are leading them down bad paths and leaving them vulnerable. I mean, all of that is very uncomfortable. So again, you reach their cowardice, their intellectual cowardice. They don't want to investigate this stuff. They want to keep believing stuff that they want to keep believing things that are false, and which they even suspect are false, because those things are familiar to them and those things buy them social credit. I think that's a crucial thing to mention in all of this, is that it's for the skeptics, it was really about being socially acceptable. I think that was a huge part of it. They knew that these ideas of the alt-right, they didn't like them, and they didn't like us, but they wanted them to go away, partly because they didn't want us to replace them, the skeptics, but also because those ideas in and of themselves scared them. It was a sort of double whammy for them. It was like, not only do I lose my prominence as an influencer, but I'm also shown up as a fool for believing this nonsense.
And then they're no longer the edgy kids on the block. That was the worst of it, because now they are having to gatekeep against actual radicals, people with actual dangerous ideas, which they wanted that. They wanted to wear that crown, and it was in danger of being taken away from them. And things got worse as well, because I remember when the first video came out, I think there was kind of confusion, because if today people talk about these like parasocial relationships people have with content creators and whatnot, and I think when say Kraut was going after Muslims or feminists or whatever, he would have kind of been on point. So his audience, which was big, I mean, his videos would get like 200,000 views.
I think he had about 150k, if I remember correctly. That was what he had at the time.
Yeah, it went down. It went down to about... He lost, because of this, he lost about 55,000 subscribers.
This is the thing. I mean, we'll get to that later, perhaps, but it really did cost him. I mean, he not only lost credibility, he lost many, many of his followers. And because I remember one of them gloating, saying something like, I'm looking forward to seeing you pass 100k, Kraut.
on the way down.
Yeah, exactly. and then we sort of waited patiently for that to happen, and it did happen.
And
remarkable.
And so it's weird, because his core audience were kind of confused as to what was going on, because there's this, you know, it's more content for them to consume by a content creator who they view as a sort of authority figure, and yet there's like half his audience thinks he's just talking shit, and that there's something gone really badly wrong here, and that he is now behaving like an SJW himself.
Well, he was behaving like an autist. He was behaving like an absolute spark, because here's the thing. His videos had been very well made, and he'd been slick, and he had a certain charisma about him. He had a way of talking that was, frankly, I quite enjoyed listening to his voice. I mean, lots of people made fun of his voice, but I thought he had a cool sort of speaking voice. And so he'd been doing these videos that were easy to watch. And so he'd garnered an audience of people who enjoy watching stuff that's easy to watch, namely midwits. And so what happened with these videos that he made against the alt-right was that he got into the minutiae of science and statistics and data. And it was a break from his previous style of very slick videos, and now it was incredibly pedantic, dry, mind-numbingly boring videos. And that is why a lot of his followers did not like it, because they were expecting fun. You know, that's what they get. That's what it is to be a skeptic. It's to watch stupid, midwit, lowbrow, happy, clappy stuff about how the SJWs are stupid and what stupid thing they've done this week. That was what they wanted and had come to expect from Kraut. So when instead he went turbo Sperg, he repelled huge numbers of them. But that was his way of taking on our ideas.
Yeah, and then so obviously what happened next in the saga was, I'd never heard of JF Gariepi before at that point, but like I say, I had a busy comment section at the blog. And then all of a sudden, there was this kind of suave Frenchman, as I saw. I didn't know originally, I just assumed he was French. And then, like, this whole saga is just getting so crazy. And then all of a sudden, you've got this kind of suave kind of Frenchman just sitting there in this sort of the dark lighting on, you know what I mean? It looked like he was just back in from some restaurant or something.
Yeah.
And it was like he'd gone online for an hour just to see what was going on. Then ended up just kind of absolutely tearing apart, like, minute by minute, everything in Kraut's video. And it was just this thing where this is just getting so out of hand now. This is just getting so funny. And then, of course, it was because he's doing it in this, Kraut was doing it in that voice where it was like, as if he was lecturing people, like a really arrogant tone that he had.
Oh, yes.
And then he mentioned it about where, like, the females are pregnant for 3 weeks or whatever it was. And that it just...
That was a terrible faux pas for him, because it made him look like an idiot, and he didn't seem to know that, you know, fish lay eggs, and I mean, how can you? I can't remember what the context was now, but it was probably something to do with evolution, and yeah, it was just embarrassing. And I remember, because I'd been sort of getting a bit nervous. I'd been thinking, oh, how tough is it going to be to refute these videos that he's going to come out with? You know, I thought that we would win, but I thought that it would be difficult. You know, I thought that it would be taxing. As it was, not in the slightest. I mean, it was laughable, absolutely laughable, that he made these, as I say, turgid, mind-numbing videos. But along the way, he would make these very obvious mistakes, these errors, which would just jump out at you. And so what I did was, it was called Krautronic Woes, and I did a logo for it and all this, and I made a special intro for it, because I thought that it was going to be a series. I thought that he was going to make quite a lot of videos. So I thought, okay, well, it's worth putting in some effort here. So I would do a response video to each of his videos. As I say, in the end, there were only four of them, which was a bit of a disappointment. But it was just so easy. And so what I was doing was having fun with it. And so I would just switch the camera on. I'd do the notes, switch the camera on, work my way through the notes and have a laugh along the way. And it was really fun. I mean, I think people, and I'm not saying this to boast at all, I'm just noting that I think my response videos were much more enjoyable than Kraut's own videos. And to be honest, the same goes for the response videos made by JF and Alternative Hypothesis. He was great. He really shone during this episode. I think everyone's response videos were much more enjoyable than the stuff that Kraut was churning out. Well, I say churning out, that's not accurate, because these videos were being made quite painstakingly, and the gap between the gaps between them grew with each one. So you could tell that there was panic in the Discord server, that they were finding it ever harder to feel confident about what they were doing, to feel confident about what they were making. Because I think after the first one, they realized, oh shit, we've really messed up here. So we've got to be even more careful than we were. We've got to up the ante, so to speak. We've got to put in more effort. And so then they did the second one, which was called The Alt-Right is Too Dumb for Genetics and Maths. And then that one also failed and was made a laughing stock. And so then the third one took... They spent ages making the third one. But then the same thing happened. And that was called The Alt-Right is Too Dumb for Genetics and Physiology. And then the fourth one, I think it took... I can't remember now. It seemed... Hold on a minute. I might be able to tell you how long it took. If I look at the 14th of November for the third one, and... Right, and so it was, I think, 3 weeks or 4 weeks before the fourth one came out. And then it was a disaster. It was incredibly turgid and difficult to watch. So he was really losing the optics war, the PR war, ironically, because he was the one who'd approached this as a PR thing. But he was losing and losing and losing because he was going into ever more autistic detail. And it was repelling his fans because there was just no jollity about it. There was no slickness about it. And the facts he was putting out and the theories he was putting out were fallacious.
Yeah, I mean, what he was doing, the reason why the titles sound so boring like that is because all of the videos were basically just squid ink. And the idea is to use so many sort of highfalutin scientific terms and, you know, all of like the language that like geneticists would use and all of this.
Yes.
And the idea is to just use all of these terms, which he knew few people would be familiar with, as a kind of squidding, so that you just kind of get lost in the mist of it all and you lose track. You don't really know what he's talking about anymore. And so it kind of saps your confidence and you think, oh, what? Wait a minute. But it is just like sophistry and bullshit. And of course, JF knew all of these terms as well, and they were even getting those wrong. But then you get the law of diminishing returns. So you get the original sort of video in the series, which is so when he releases the first one, he's got the goodwill of his large audience.
Yes, and the curiosity as well. There's some anticipation about it.
And then by the time you get into the second and the third video, all of his core audience just don't really know what's going on anymore. And they are also, you know, the way the internet is, everyone's in networks and networks and networks. And so they are now being confronted with what's going on here is that like Kraut is in a war with the alt-right and he's losing really badly. It just went all like really to hell. And on the back end, there was all kinds of weird stuff going on with like he was kind of begging other people to like start and drop videos, and he was coming up with like weird schemes to manipulate people like Sargon into sort of making videos against the alt-right and all of this shady weird shit that was going on, the whole kind of Don Sargon thing.
Yeah, that was hilarious. I'd actually forgotten a lot of this stuff. That I remember there was some controversy, a storm in a teacup kind of thing, really, to do with one of his Discord moderators who I think turned rogue or Kraut fucked him over in some way, so the guy turned rogue. And there were chat logs being released, all of that. All of that was going on while simultaneously with him making these videos. And so it was just bizarre. And I remember really commenting, maybe not publicly, but to friends at the time, he seems to be having a meltdown. I mean, he seems to be going crazy. He's obsessed. And he can't possibly win. I mean, how can he not see that he can't possibly win? And I think at one point I actually reached out to him privately and said, look, you know, you don't have to do this. If you want to talk, I'm here. Again, I was so fucking nice in those days. I don't know why I was so nice. And I remember he didn't even reply to that message. And so that was the last time I communicated with him. But yeah, it was... And I think he did sort of drive himself to... Not a breakdown. Well, maybe he did have a breakdown, but I don't know. But definitely he burnt out, for sure. I mean...
The thing is, I was never as interested in all of the kind of the gay ops in the Discord server than what I was with the sort of the ideological battle that was happening front and center. And in the end, I think it was the gay ops stuff which did him in, because he was also kind of betraying all of his friends and they seemed to be all talking about people behind their backs, and there was audio tapes of them and all of this kind of thing. And I thought, well, yeah, okay, but now it's kind of descending into the realms of gossip, and that he's clearly like gone mad. And I was interested in how this was affecting the general discourse. Or like, are we now going to make a breakthrough? And I think we did, to be honest. The problem is, like, what we didn't understand was that mass censorship was just around the corner.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, I'd say a bit more about him, and you're right that it was all this skull, the cloak and dagger stuff, and skullduggery, treachery, and manipulation, trying to get people to do things. I remember he had a friend, Naked Ape, who, and there was this video came out of them having a conversation on Discord or something, where Naked Ape was just tearing him apart for what he was doing. I think I'm remembering that correctly, that it happened around this time.
There was two of them.
Oh, I only saw one.
there was Naked Ape, and then there was another. There was a girl called Aiden Paladin.
Oh yes, yes.
Yeah. And basically, so what Naked Ape was saying on that audio was.